Okay, this is session 16, side 2, September 12th, 2006. We're on page 32 of my book. We're in the LaRouche thread, and we're at the bottom, page 32, and we're continuing the essay called The Science of the Human Mind, A Treatise on Fundamentals by LaRouche, written for the Campaigner in February 1984. So we've talked about technological progress as the precondition even for merely maintaining a fixed constant value of potential relative population density. He's saying that you've got to have that, keep working, making more population density. You've got to have technology to maintain that. And you got to keep that level going and almost get a little more technology just to maintain that level.
Mm-hmm.
So now he's going to relate this to normal assumptions in the society. So here we go.
However, to overcome absolutely the apparent limits to growth associated with the, quote, natural resources of a fixed range of technology, there must be technological revolutions periodically through which leaps in potential relative population density occur. Moreover, technological progress always tends to cause a net increase in the required social division of total labor, which in turn signifies an increase of population, and therefore population density. Thus, increase of potential relative population density is the irreducible datum required. It is human activity integral to affecting that increase of potential, which is the irreducible definition of human activity. It is that specific irreducible datum of human activity which correlates directly to those qualities of the human mind which distinguish humanity absolutely from the beasts. This, quote, economic form of human activity is mapped to the activity of the human mind by aid of Plato's conception of the hypothesis of higher hypothesis. From the standpoint of hypotheses, example, irrational problem solving.
Example, rational.
Rational problem-solving activity of the mind. The human mind has three distinguishable states. One, simple hypothesis. Two, higher hypothesis. And three, hypothesis of higher hypothesis.
Hypothesis of the higher hypothesis.
These are summarily defined as follows using modern language. Simple hypothesis. On the lowest level of human problem-solving, rational activity, we attempt to comprehend a problem by aid of the assumption that prevailing opinion is broadly correct. We seek to describe the problem considered in a manner which is credible and acceptable either to prevailing assumptions of general opinion or the body of opinion associated with some chosen professional or other peer group of reference. This is what is sometimes described as, quote, other-directed. As an, quote, other-directed state of mind, which limits one's self-approved thoughts to such thoughts that be proved among generally prevailing authorities and so forth.
So here we have, he's saying, the simple level of rational human activity, as opposed to animal activity, is that we accept the assumptions around us and work within them. Same old point, right?
Right.
And those assumptions are termed by certain charismatic people in the society or chosen experts or your neighbor's approval, you know, family's approval, all the pressures of normal social life.
Yeah, and we really see that in the peer pressure among teenagers.
Yeah.
In scientific work, the peer group of reference is one's old university professors, and this is in parentheses, who awarded one the social professional status of a scientific degree. One's professional peers, as typified by co-workers and referees of professional publications, current prospective employers, and so forth. The prevailing, an example, textbook, latticework of algebraic formulations and axiomatic assumptions directly or implicitly underlying such latticeworks are accepted as broadly inalterable, and similar assumptions are made bearing on prevailing professional opinion in the specialized domain of experimental practice in which the problem treated is assumed to lie. The formulation of the hypothesis seeks
formulation of the simple hypothesis.
Of the simple hypothesis seeks consistency with such lattice works.
So lattice works is a bigger phrase for a group of assumptions that you are working with and you know you have to match with. And this is due to peer group pressure from your seniors or your co-workers or Visual Space, the textbook.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, lattice work of algebraic. He doesn't like algebraic formulations, but that's what our culture relies on.
Mm.
He wants to do synthetic geometry, which is redoing the original theorems and principles by trial and error, doing by learning by doing, you know.
Mm.
Okay, next paragraph.
Persons in this state of mind will never discover anything of useful importance bearing upon fundamental issues of scientific knowledge. Worse, they will be hostile to creative discoveries, no matter how exhaustively, conclusively demonstrated, and will have enormous difficulty in attempting to master such discoveries. If obliged by pressures of practical circumstance to employ such a discovery, they will attempt to explain the discovery away, to reject the method by which the discovery was actually formulated.
That is the iron level of souls, to use the Phoenician mythology. It's the simple hypothesis level, or the irrational view.
Oh.
Now we're going to go to the Aristotelian view. It's also simple hypothesis, Dionysian, embedded in the sensory matrix.
Right, and he includes the use of algebra as being...
Yeah, that's Newtonian and inferior mathematics.
Hmm. Why is that?
Because Newton stole Leibniz's breakthrough in differential calculus and muddied it and kind of ignored the geometric underlying of it.
Hmm.
Geometry was important up to the point of Newton.
Mm-hmm. Now we're moving on to the
second level, higher
hypothesis. Yeah, higher hypothesis. In this approach to problem solving, the thinker rejects the, quote, other directedness of simple hypothesis.
That's peer pressure.
Yeah. He is interested chiefly in those kinds of experiments which test one or more of the underlying axiomatic assumptions of prevailing opinion, and expects to be able, sooner or later, to overturn one or more of such assumptions through a, quote, crucial experimental demonstration. This creative thinker is inherently a, quote, iconoclast in the eyes of his, quote, other-directed fellow professionals, as they, and they, quote, Philistines in his eyes, as such, were in the eyes of Plato's Socrates.
So that's Jack Sarfati. He's on this level. He's considered an iconoclast.
He is, quote, inner-directed. He must prove everything for himself, especially those features of the logic must work in which are axiomatic. The formulation of the higher hypothesis is best accomplished by a thorough education in the internal history of ideas, especially scientific ideas, with reliance upon original sources of present and past. This historical approach to contemporary scientific work emphasizes those kinds of axiomatic assumptions which are, in italics, logical, which bear directly on identifying which aspects of the universe as a whole are properly treated as efficiently substantial, and how on such ontological assumptions implicitly, and also how such ontological assumptions implicitly determine the method of adducing the lawful principles governing action in the universe. From such a historically informed vantage point, the thinker is able to recognize that the elaborated logical lattice work of algebraic formulations associated with some branch of scientific inquiry is a kind of, quote, hereditary elaboration of the axiomatic ontological methodological assumptions which underlie those constructed edifices of algebraic formulations. From this vantage point, the thinker is enabled to recognize that certain classes of experimental problems put an entire edifice of that sort into question. That such certain classes of experimental problems, properly defined in that light, have implicitly a, quote, crucial or, quote, revolutionary significance for scientific knowledge in general.
So he's saying that the second level of thinker is going to attack the assumptions, or try to figure out how to create an experiment that undermines the assumptions, that stirs up problems, and he becomes seen as an iconoclast, and he sees his normal, simple hypothesis, peer-pressured people as Philistines. So LaRouche is, in the next paragraph, listing off algebraic formulations and hereditary as a bunch of assumptions that have been around too long, and those experiments that upset, historically, upset cultural assumptions like Galileo or Copernicus with the idea of the sun going around Earth, right? Major experiments, that they are crucial and revolutionary in knowledge. Not the establishing, he's saying people should go back and study the history of science and history of ideas and new breakthroughs to understand the pattern that it's not what people knew, it's the revolutionary upset that a new experiment created that's significant.
Mm-hmm.
It's the upset. So he's saying, you kids are, in the late 60s, he goes into Columbia University, and he says, you kids are learning from guys who are just trying to tell you about the past, and it's an inadequate presentation of the past. I offer you a way of, a dynamic way of exploring the past and moving towards not consolidating what you think you know.
Mm-hmm.
He became influential in the SDS movement with his particular cadre.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right when it was a big deal with Mark Redden, those people in the spring of 68, LaRouche's people were right in the middle of that, major instigators. Though that was not portrayed in the media as that. They probably people in the media didn't even know about LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
So, the next paragraph.
Yeah, about the SDS, the Star Wars initiative, that would require massive...
No, that's SDI.
SDI.
Yeah. SDS is the Students for Democratic Society, the radicals in the late 60s.
Oh, okay.
So you forget that then? We're going to go to SDI. No, SDS is the famous radical student movements of the 60s. LaRouche had a hand in creating a lot of turmoil,
mm-hmm.
upsetting assumptions
mm-hmm.
through his cadre in the New York SDS.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're going on to the next paragraph?
Yeah. So the formulation of a higher form of experimental hypothesis is addressed to some selection of empirical evidence, evidence which is appropriate to prove whether or not certain prevailing assumptions of scientific work must now be overturned in order that scientific and technological progress might continue. If this experiment is successful, a greater or lesser scientific revolution, or the equivalent of some other aspect of knowledge, results. If this occurs, the entire edifice of mathematical knowledge resting hereditarily upon flawed assumptions collapses, and a new replacement edifice must be constructed according to the hereditary implications of the newly proven principle. In the final analysis, the question whether such experimental proof of new principle is valid or not is determined. And this next is all italicized. Does this discovery implicitly lead to an increase of potential relative population density of society? Does the discovery affect an increase in mankind's per capita power over nature as a whole?
You think those are the qualifiers to determine whether it was a successful revolutionary experiment.
Mm-hmm. There are many false discoveries which purport to be of this form. Everywhere, this or that anarchist whose ego has been inflated by a little professional learning prankishly deludes himself that iconoclasm, for its own sake, merely being eccentrically different constitutes valid discovery.
Right, so here's where he's saying you may appear to be a iconoclast to others, but there is a Platonic iconoclast versus an Aristotelian iconoclast, you know.
Mm.
Someone who has fan fantasies. It just is upsetting people without any experimental, serious scientific work is just silly. And he's going to give some examples here.
The case of the so-called modernism in art today, or 19th century romanticism, is illustrative. Fellows who have never mastered Albertinian...
Albertian perspective, that's like 1500.
Albertian perspective, to say nothing of Leonardo's system of convex spherical mirror projection, delude themselves that childish smears, echoing infantile smears of feces on walls, constitutes an expression of, quote, creative freedom.
So all the great artists of the 20th century, he's saying, are numbskulls. You know, Picasso, Surrealists, Abstract Expressionists, right?
Mm-hmm.
All modernists.
Yeah. In music, those who have no comprehension of the principle of coherent contrapuntal development, such as that of the post-1782 Mozart or Beethoven, delude themselves to surpass the classical masters by the anarchistic chromatic imbecilities of a Liszt or Wagner, or the irrational nihilism of Webern and Schoenberg.
Weber
and Schoenberg.
So he's putting those guys down.
Yeah. In scientific work, such feces-smearing artistic productions would be regarded as the bungling of illiterate tinkerers.
In scientific work, such feces-smearing artistic productions would be regarded as the bungling of illiterate tinkerers. Okay, next. That was bullshit.
Yeah. In significant degree, the toleration of such artistic and social sciences frauds by society today echoes a breakdown in primary and secondary education. If students today were educated standards of classical education associated with the 18th century French, Italian
oratorians,
the leading schools of the young United States or the Humboldt program in Germany, the graduates of secondary institutions would already possess a much higher degree of education and fundamentals than is commanded by more than a tiny minority of professionals holding terminal degrees today. The steeping of the student...
Note that terminal degrees, that implies that all degrees are terminal.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be obsolete.
Mm-hmm. The steeping of the student in the original classes, beginning with...
The original classics.
Classics, beginning with Greek classics, is not a necessary exposure of the student to dead languages and, quote, outdated opinions. It is affording the student with both familiarity with the past 2,500 years of development of ideas of Western civilization and the power to think of ideas in terms of universality and historicity. Out of such education emerges a sense of rigorous thinking, the power to discriminate between new eruptions of what has been proven trivial nonsense many times in the past, and genuinely new solutions to problems left unresolved from the entirety of whole spans of work of mankind up to the present. For example, all fundamental accomplishments in modern European mathematical physics over the recent 500 years are derived hereditarily from the work of Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa. Cusa's adolescent training was under Brothers of the Common Life, education based on rigorous reworking of the classics prior to mid-adolescence.
Reworking of the classics, redoing this geometrical problems.
Mm-hmm. Cusa's principal discoveries in science centered around his thorough reworking of the writing of Archimedes. Most emphatically, Cusa's rediscovery of the isoperimetric principle of topology is a superior approach to that of Archimedes in treatment of the problem of the quadrature of the circle. The genius Karl Gauss, the great thinker of the past few centuries, is typified by and centered in work through reworking of the work of Kepler. In, is it George?
Yeah.
Cantor's
Grundlegen,
in which Cantor summarizes the solution to comprehension of transfinite manifolds. Cantor devotes most of the writing to reviewing the preceding century's work in that same direction.
Okay, so he's listing off the greats, our Nicholas of Cusa around the time 1450 and the Council of Florence and the Greeks, Constantinople scholars coming over to, 1453 is when Constantinople collapses, you know, the last wing of the Roman Empire. And this, the knowledge that was centered there was taken over to Italy, and the Medici family sponsored them in Florence. And Cusa was part of that network.
Mm-hmm.
A very important person. Though, if you want to think of LaRouche as a Vatican agent, he's propping up a cardinal as an important guy. The Vatican today might like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, and then there's Carl Gauss around the time of the French Revolution, and then George Cantor 100 years ago. That is the major people who are revivifying the Platonic method. The problem of quadrature of the circle, I'm not sure if that's the squaring of the circle problem. Anyways, it's an ongoing problem. How to figure out the size of the circle.
The area? The area within the contained within the circle?
Yeah. So I just want to say that. The next. So we're talking about the second level, the level of higher hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. The work of formulating valid higher hypothesis is not less rigorous than that of formulating simple hypothesis. It's far more rigorous, more demanding upon the historical education in depth and concentration span of the investigator.
So he's advocating that young people redo the whole history of education from the Greeks on so they can understand the broader historical trends and be, as a result, more creative in dealing with the present. They must rework the discoveries.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to do on your own unless the educational system is set up to help facilitate that.
Yeah.
But it isn't.
Yeah.
The work of formulating valid higher hypothesis is not less rigorous than that of formulating simple hypothesis. It's far more rigorous, more demanding upon historical education in depth and concentration span of the investigator. Okay, I just reread that. Once one has worked through one such discovery, as the author experienced in the culmination of 5 years of work in 1952 in his fundamental discovery of economic science.
That's what he was talking about himself.
Right. One has broken through into the inside of the matter of method and form, that vantage point.
And from that vantage point.
From that vantage point to descend once more into the lower realm of simple hypothesis is like eating bad dish water for soup. The term, quote, genius for persons associated with fundamental scientific discoveries is an unfortunately mystical and therefore wickedly misleading choice of term. Quote, genius is learned as a development of potential inherent in every newborn biologically undamaged, with a biologically undamaged mental apparatus of every newborn human individual. Depth and width of development of that potential, strongly motivated, quote, inner directedness, and the experience of one good work through true discovery are all that is required to bring forth such potentialities in almost any human being.
Someone's got to really work at this and make a discovery, and then you're really on the second level.
Yeah.
You have an understanding of a... You're moving towards the third level, but you have an understanding of the method of higher hypothesis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like McLuhan, he thinks that there's too much mystical babble around the idea of genius.
Mm-hmm.
He says genius is learned.
From this vantage point, we must view as criminal the educational policies associated with John Dewey and the more radical steps in the same direction fostered by the National Education Association under influence of national training laboratories during the more recent decades.
John Dewey is like in the 10s, 20s, 30s, 40s.
Yeah, he developed the Dewey Decimal System for the library.
I don't know about that. I didn't know that.
Maybe not. Maybe I'm...
Yeah, I don't think so.
Okay. Where proper education might have produced legions of, quote, true geniuses, we permit our children to be encouraged in irrational infantilism to protect them from, quote, opposition of rigorous development.
Protect them from the oppression.
The oppression of rigorous development of their creative potentials in depth and breadth of classical and pre-science education, and to not deny them the development of that rational maturity indispensable to survive psychologically as adults.
Now we're coming to the third level. Hypothesis of the higher hypothesis.
A hypothesis.
So he's again saying that we're not going to get any geniuses if we coddle the children and have them learn assumptions and don't push them. Now we're doomed if we don't do that. We protect them from rigorous education.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean education memorizing things like normal education that
right.
we've had.
Yeah. Yeah, increasing population density is not going to help unless we increase the rate at which we produce new genius.
Yeah.
Okay, back to the book. The hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. The fact that successions of higher hypothesis, and then in parentheses, scientific technological revolutions, prompt increase of potential relative population density of society, implies that such a succession of scientific revolutions has an ordered character. In other words, a succession of higher hypotheses subsuming such an ordered succession of scientific technological revolutions has an ordered character. This defines a new experimental problem for hypotheses, the experiment which isolates the consistent feature of successive scientific revolutions, the common principle of discovering unity, of discovery uniting revolutions which are otherwise different. This defines an hypothesis of the higher hypotheses.
So an underlying ground pattern. So you look at all the developments, breakthroughs, and you might find a method underneath that that shows you how to invent it even more. What is it? McLuhan said that the 19th, or he quoted someone who said that the invention of the 19th century was a technique of discovery, whereas the invention of the big discovery of the 20th century was a technique of suspended judgment. But the idea that they figured out how to make discoveries, which is sort of like Poe talking about how you create poems when you're interested in an effect, in some way LaRouche is describing a 19th century method. He is saying there is a way where we can figure out the method of discovery.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just something to think about on the side.
Mm-hmm.
So, you want to carry on?
Just as no experimental hypotheses can be the last word in human knowledge, the same is true for successful hypotheses of the higher hypotheses.
Yeah, so he's saying we may get a pattern, but it ain't necessarily going to be forever.
Mm-hmm. It cannot be perfect, and it need not be perfect. It is required that the successive improvements in this hypothesis successfully direct man to the needed next step upward through scientific revolutions.
Yeah, so he's not saying you got to be perfectly, think of modern science, you got to prove it and rigorously prove it. He's saying, no hypothesis can be totally correct, so we don't have to be totally rigorous about proving it.
And this relates to the translation of communication from the preconscious to the conscious. He's saying that, by the time you've translated the preconscious into symbolic communication, you've distorted it and it's not perfect. And you have to try again and again and again to make it better.
Right.
It is this latter activity, successful testing of the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, that true human scientific creativity lies. This is the irreducible feature of human intellect which distinguishes man from the beast, the irreducible datum of a science of the human mind.
Yeah, now he's back to the original. We've gone over 10 pages here in these two quotes. Where did this start? Page 30, at the beginning of these quotes, And the one before that we did, he talked about the human mind. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
This inventing, this Platonic method is the human activity. And he points out how this distinguishes us from beasts. So that theme he's come back to here. He says, I want to read this whole hypothesis thing again. Hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. The fact that successions of higher hypotheses, scientific technological revolutions, prompt increase of potential relative population density of society, implies that such a succession of scientific revolutions has an ordered character. There's another pattern underlying them. In other words, a method, almost. In other words, the succession of higher hypotheses subsuming such an ordered succession of scientific technological revolutions has an ordered character. This defines a new experimental problem for a hypothesis, the experiment which isolates the consistent feature of successive scientific revolutions, the common principle of discovery, uniting revolutions which are otherwise different. This defines an hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. Just as no experimental hypothesis can be the last word in human knowledge, the same is true for the successful hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. It cannot be perfect, and it need not be perfect. A hypothesis successfully direct man to the needed next step upward through scientific revolutions. So the pattern is pointing to the next breakthrough. It is in this latter activity, successful testing. Do that again. It is in this latter activity. What activity? Successful testing of the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis that true human scientific creativity lies. So there lies the true method. In this third level, successful testing of the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. He goes on, this is the irreducible feature of human mental activity which distinguishes man from the beast, the irreducible datum of a science of the human mind. So he's saying the basic principle of a science of the human mind has to say that we're nowhere near like animals. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, look what...
It kind of seems self-evident when it's thought about in those terms that we are certainly more than animals.
Yeah, so that's where there's something not necessarily revolutionary in what he's talking about. He's just restating the common Western dream of technological progress and so-called rational or common reason.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be juggling that as we go through the LaRouche thing. I just want to look at... We started on the bottom page 28. We went up 14 pages. 14 number-wise. We actually did 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. We did 8 pages in those two quotes. So that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that hard to understand, as we've built up an understanding of it before we did today's work.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're...
It'd be hard to understand, actually. Like, people who have joined LaRouche cult, scientists and that, say that, I couldn't figure out what the method was. They can't get a finger on what this hypothesis of the higher hypothesis is. It sort of comes across as vague or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe they weren't paying attention. But let's see if the quotes I unfold here lead us somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
As we go through the LaRouche quadrant. Now, what's interesting about studying LaRouche is that we oscillate between, is he just an old fuddy-duddy demanding the old form of art and culture up against a whole new situation caused by an electronic society that he can't handle? That is something to consider when we question the assumptions of LaRouche using mm-hmm. the Platonic method, right?
Yeah. He kind of seems like a 19th century, somewhat provincial kind of a guy.
Yeah, but then he does pretty good on abstraction sometimes and says things other people don't usually say and puts together, it's his encyclopedic cross-discipline perspective that makes him kind of unique, his non-specialist. So in that sense, he's a throwback to the 18th century.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go on to another quote where we're going to talk about music and what we've heard about the general three levels of simple hypothesis and then higher hypothesis and the third level of the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. Let's see how he applies this to music. And, of course, you'll come across a Platonic form of music versus an Aristotelian kind of pagan or inferior music. And this is a quote from The Campaigner again, September 1979, and the article is called How to Introduce Beethoven to American Laymen. And this is page 9 of that article. So you want to move forward?
Okay. First, let us consider the issue in terms of a purely formal problem.
Now, you see how I've juxtaposed that sentence to what we've just heard. He's laid out the three hypotheses, and now I'm sort of imagining the reader saying, okay, we're going to apply the three levels to purely a formal problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though the quote comes from something else.
Either the whole of musical development represents a coherent domain, and this coherent lawfulness is therefore the primary reality of music, or the notes of the 12-tone scale are the self-evidently, quote, atomic sensualities of music.
The 12-tone scale is Schoenberg, who he puts down, therefore they're involved with the Aristotelian senses and atomic particles. Remember, Luce doesn't believe in using pairwise atom-electron kind of categories, right?
Mm-hmm. What kind of scale does he like?
Beg your pardon?
What musical scale does he prefer?
Well, we're not talking about musical scale.
Well, you see, he's putting down the 12-tone scale.
His main term is contrapuntal.
Mm-hmm.
And what he calls, he refers to Bach's well-tempered system.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not talking about scale necessarily. The 12-tone scale was a new development in the 20th century. And it sort of...
basis of Western music, isn't it?
Beg your pardon?
It's the basis of Western music, isn't it?
No, I think the 12-tone is Schoenberg. Because just as atoms and that, electrons, were kind of developed in the late 19th century...
Mm-hmm.
It's that period when this new kind of music started to come through that he doesn't approve of, so he's paralleling the Schoenberg school of music, this revolutionary, what do you call, anarchistic dumping of Bach and Mozart's principles for particular atomic, particular particle sensualities of music that he has here in quotes, atomic.
Mm-hmm.
So he'll explain this. So far you said either the whole of music, now here he's referring to saying that there must be a higher hypothesis going on here, there must be a hypothesis, a higher hypothesis, or a coherent domain underlying the development of music, or what he calls a coherent lawfulness. So he says, either the whole of musical development represents a coherent domain, and this coherent lawfulness is therefore the primary reality of music, or, the opposite, the notes of the 12-tone scale are the self-evidently atomic, and he puts that in quotes, sensualities of music. That's a put-down.
Mm-hmm.
Or he's betting on the coherent domain rather than the 12-tone development. So,
if the former,
the coherent domain.
Yeah, the coherent domain. Then the notes are determined in value by the requirements of a system which is coherent with respect to all of the lawfully ordered development within music.
That's the scale he's talking about. If the former, then the notes are determined in value by the requirements of a system which is coherent with respect to all of the lawfully ordered development within music. Sounds like bigger ground. Go ahead.
If the latter, then the values of the notes as self-evident, quote, atoms of sensuality can be determined by any variously arbitrary or consistent standards apart from music.
Yeah, so he's saying you can actually make up stuff if you go the Aristotelian method. But not lead to the coherent domain that enhances creativity, real creativity that leads to significant experimental demonstrations that leads to higher technology and deeper population density.
Mm-hmm. Continuing, in the latter case, music is axiomatically degraded to a matter of sensual effects.
Okay, see, we're going from the Platonic to the Aristotelian. Schoenberg represents the Aristotelian sensory embedment. Sensory determined music, and it's not following the Platonic principles. So again, we have the same dialectic, but now applied to music.
Mm.
Right?
Yeah. So I'm trying to get I'm not all that familiar with classical music, so maybe I'm not making all the connections in my brain, but I'm wondering how music differs when it's ruled by this logoic sense of reasoning and discovery in that dimension, as opposed to allowing it to be the product of sensory sensory enjoyment.
Right. So it's an interesting, almost sounds Puritan, prudish.
Mm-hmm.
But let's continue. He's going to try to explain that.
Okay. The former standpoint is the Platonic or Neoplatonic epistemological standpoint, as exemplified by Plato's Timaeus. The latter standpoint...
That was one of the books.
Mm-hmm. The latter standpoint is that of Aristotle and his successors, and coincides with the classical arguments of the British Secret Intelligence Service in adopting Rameau, as its prophet during the British monarchy's attempted inquisition against Bach during Bach's period of Leipzig.
At Leipzig. So here you have, he's talking about music, suddenly he leaps and applies it to politics and says intelligence agencies are promoting the Aristotelian as opposed to the Platonic method. Okay?
Mm-hmm. The Aristotelian standpoint was also the common standpoint of Goethe, Mendelssohn, and Richard Wagner, among others. In those persons...
Philippics
against the line of development of musical composition exemplified by Beethoven.
Faithlessness.
The same issue was reflected, although in an often confused form, in both the principal Wagner controversies of the late 19th and early 20th centuries between Wagnerians and Brahmsians. Mm. In the one case, and Wagnerian and Verdians in another.
Verdis.
Yeah. Although both Brahms and Verdi reflected the depressing influence of the romantic decay of 19th century musical and other aspects of European culture relative to the Wagnerians, they were the same currents, and represented to that extent the continuation of the thrust of Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, etc.
Yeah, now, the point is that as you move into the 19th century and the American Revolution's being stultified and its supporters are being stopped in Europe, the culture is going downhill, and the romantic Aristotelianism is taking over in Europe, and it's becoming a crummy century, basically. So he's saying those that were Platonists were operating in an inferior environment, atmosphere, and their work wasn't as great as Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven. And those, even though they, as Platonists, were better than Wagner and people and Mendelssohn.
Mm-hmm. And then, I don't want to really go off track with this question, but it just a thought occurred to me. I'm wondering if that shaping and what LaRouche considers to be degradation in McLuhan terms, he would have said, well, it was inevitable that that music would have moved in that direction given the media environment of the time.
McLuhan would say that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's right. But McLuhan is, from LaRouche's point of view, is relying on sensory details caused by media.
Mm-hmm.
Not thinking through and past that with mm-hmm. the higher hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting, we're now going to get into a particular technicality where he's going to try to explain the notes, what system he's using, the relationship of musical notes, and he's going to use a word called ephemerals. Mm-hmm. So let's see if we can understand what this is.
From the Platonic standpoint, the notes of the well-tempered system are ephemerals. A student must not be left misguided on the significance of that term. Quote, ephemeral is not equivalent to, quote, sloppy, quote, arbitrary, or, quote, illusory. Indeed, individual life is an ephemeral in the whole development of humanity. Yet an individual person is not only definite, but what he or she may do to secure a meaningful place in the process of human development as a whole is also a definite matter. The notes within a well-tempered system have a determined exact value as notes. There is no caprice, no margin for indifference within the range of audible discriminations. or within a tolerable range of beats produced by the variation between produced tones of the same nominal set of values. When we insist that the values of notes are ephemerals, we are merely insisting that the value of musical notes are not determined a priori, independently of music. We are merely insisting that the principles of lawful development necessary to effect beauty within musical composition rigorously determine the value of the values of the notes, with no obligation to any a prioristic assumption of what those sensual values must be independently of beautiful music.
So no assumptions, no abstract ideas, what McLuhan called visual space, is not independent of music. So he's almost advocating, from McLuhan's point of view, an oral basis in music, or a non-visual bias music. I want to read that paragraph again, those last two paragraphs.
Okay.
Oh, no, let's do the last little paragraph, and then we'll redo it.
All right.